This is On Location. I'm Tim Leitner. Today's episode comes to you from Washington, D.C. and Anchorage, Alaska. But first, On Location is produced by the NCA Communications Committee with special production assistance from Joe Mamlin and me. You can find our podcast on iTunes, Anchor, Spotify, Google Podcast, Breaker, iHeartRadio, and Radio Public, among others. So subscribe today on your favorite podcast service and tell all your friends. Today's On Location podcast was recorded on Wednesday, May 17th of 2023. I had the opportunity to host a conversation with Tom Joseph, who's the Vice President and Managing Partner for Paragon Government Relations in Washington, D.C. Learn about Tom and his leadership journey, as well as how he got involved in the child support community and child support issues. Hear what services Tom provides to NCA and the importance of this partnership. Listen as Tom talks about legislative updates from Capitol Hill as they relate to child support, including the IRS FTI notice that came out in February, the Tribal Child Support Enforcement Act, the House Ways and Means Work and Welfare Subcommittee hearing titled "Welfare is Broken: Restoring Work Requirements to Lift Americans Out of Poverty," and the federal debt ceiling and the federal budget. It's going to be a great show, so stick around, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to another weekly edition of NCA On Location, coming to you from Washington, D.C. and Alaska. I'm Tim Leitner with CGI in Anchorage, Alaska, and I'm pleased to welcome a first-time guest that has been a part of NCA's mission for quite a while. Today, I'm happy to introduce to you Tom Joseph, Vice President and Managing Partner of Paragon Government Relations. Tom, if you would, please introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about who Tom Joseph is.
Thanks, Tim, and happy to participate on this podcast. So let me start out with describing my professional career. I started work in the health and human services sphere in the early 1980s, so shortly after the Abraham Lincoln administration. I started my work at the National Association of Counties and worked there for about 16 years, was lobbyist for their health and human services portfolio, and ultimately became their deputy legislative director for the organization, so helped manage and oversee their policy process, as well as the efforts of the 10 lobbyists that they had on staff at that point. Following that, Los Angeles County recruited me to stand up a lobbying shop for them. They had contractors in DC, but they didn't have a full-time LA County employee to help manage those contractors. So they hired me to help stand up that office. And I still worked on health and human services issues, but helped manage the operations of that county, which is, 10 million people and five elected officials. So the elected officials there, the county board supervisors, each represented more individuals than their members of Congress did. They each represented about 2 million people. So it was a good opportunity to grow and get to learn hands-on how to work with a very large organization. After that, Paragon Government Relations recruited me. That was about 16 years ago now. I'm now a managing partner with them. I handle the health and human services portfolio as well as housing and homelessness. On a personal level, my wife is a federal employee. She works on the Community Health Center program on behalf of HHS. So she and I talk shop at the kitchen table in the evenings. And our two adult daughters, must have been listening to us having those conversations because one is just finishing law school with a very much passionate about immigration law. And the second daughter just finished her second year of law school and is interested in family law. Neither Jen or I are attorneys, but that's the paths that our girls are taking. I'm also a beekeeper. I have three hives in my backyard, managed, which means I've got about 150,000 bees during the summer that do not bother my neighbors. I've yet to get to know the names of each and every one of those bees, but they produce about 80 to 100 pounds of honey every year. I don't sell it. I give it to friends, neighbors, family, the plumber who comes to fix my plumbing, and a stray turtle or two. And one more thing, I also can talk like Donald Duck. It scares the hell out of small children, I've learned. And I decided I'm not going to conduct this podcast speaking like Donald Duck. It would make a podcast for the ages, but I don't think people would totally understand what Donald Duck has to do with child support. So that's a little bit about me professionally and personally, Tim.
You know, Tom, I've got to say, it sounds like quite the family affair, and I would imagine the dinner table at the family events are quite lively and really focused on some of those discussions. And I for one, am learning much more about Tom Joseph than I ever knew. And you know, especially the beekeeping sounds fascinating to me.
Yeah, it is. It's one of those things, and I know we'll get into the work of the podcast, but I was a beekeeper in high school in my home state of Minnesota, helping a high school teacher who, in the summertime, that was his job. He had over 200 hives. So I went to many farms over the summers to help process that honey for him, and then just took it up about 6 years ago or so. And I feel like a kid again whenever I'm out there with my bees. So yes, it's something I enjoy.
Very cool. Very cool. So I've got to ask, how did you get involved with the child support community and child support issues?
Good question. You know, it started out because I was working at NACO, National Association of Counties on Health and Human Services issues. I touched upon it every so often, as I did with working with Los Angeles County. But it wasn't until I joined Paragon Government Relations, where I had a couple of clients at the time that were involved in child support, the National Association of County Human Services Administrators and the Wisconsin Counties Association. And I started the work on child support in particular around 2004 or so, when Congress was beginning to debate the Deficit Reduction Act. And within that bill, as many of your listeners may remember, there was a provision that was going to eliminate the ability for child support agencies to match their performance incentive funds, to match that and draw down additional federal dollars. It was within the law for many years, but at that point, a number of members of Congress decided that that was double dipping. So I was working with Wisconsin County's directors and NACSA, the Human Services Administrators, lobbying the issue on the Hill, would go to the ENSEA meetings to join up with the Wisconsin directors before we hit the Hill. And it was also the time that I met Vicki Turetsky, who at that point was with the Center for Law and Social Policy. She was the child support expert. She and I hit the Hill often. She ended up being sort of one of my first mentors of many within child support. And albeit the effort was unsuccessful, it was, you know, included in the DRA. Vicki and I and others worked for a couple more years trying to overturn that policy. And somewhere along the line, that's when ENSEA learned about me, because they saw me at some of the ENSEA conferences. They knew of my relationship with Vicki Turetsky for the Office of Child Support Enforcement. And about 2010, entered into a formal relationship with ENSEA. and have proudly served ENSEA ever since, and continue to be struck by the passion, the expertise, the level of involvement of the ENSEA leadership. All of the leaders have full-time, 24/7, high visibility jobs, and yet they find the time to devote to ENSEA. And I've just found that over the years to just be really impressive, and have gained a number of mentors within the community post Vicki Turetsky.
Yeah, that's amazing you say that, to mention Vicki's name and to remember her and all her contributions, and then just the tie-ins with people that are not just passionate, but that find the time to be involved and to contribute and all that. It really is amazing. And I'm sure now some of our listeners may be wondering what exactly Paragon Government Relations is, and why does ENSEA have a federal lobbying firm? Can you tell us more and why this is important for ENSEA? And you mentioned a little bit about how long you've been involved, but if you can just kind of talk a little bit more about that.
Sure, of course. I'd be happy to, Tim. So I think as things evolved before I joined ENSEA, a number of the members thought, hey, you know, federal relations, it's something that I should be able to do on my own. I can contact my members on the Hill. Why would we need somebody in D.C. to do that for me? And I think over time, ENSEA has learned that there is value in having representation, because somebody like myself or other firms for that matter can become an association's eyes, ears, and voice with the involvement of the membership. That members within associations literally do have full-time jobs, but it's my full-time job to ensure that associations such as ENSEA views and policies are represented before staff and before members when appropriate. So that's I think that's how ENSEA became to believe that it was a good thing. It was of value to have somebody on board full time in DC, not only to sort of give a sense of the climate in DC, but to know that, for instance, federal regulations come out a day or two early here via a separate channel that I can then alert the membership to be prepared to allow them to distribute that kind of news quickly and immediately to their colleagues.
Yeah, so important. So Tom, let's talk a little bit about something really up your alley. Let's talk about some legislative updates from the Hill and allow our listeners to hear what goes on in our nation's capital that relates to the child support program. So let's start with the action to resolve the IRS or the FTI notice. Can you tell us what that memo said that came out recently, when it came out, what it was about, and what's happening?
Sure, I'd be happy to do so. Let me back up for just a second, Tim, and talk about sort of our overall approach to reaching the Hill on that matter and in others. As you and probably your listeners would surmise, you know, the child support staff on the Hill has child support as just one piece of a huge portfolio of health and human services issues. So they and their members, and there's oftentimes turnover, especially among staff, may not really be that well apprised or aware of what child support is. So it's been our job, continuous job, to describe the program and remind them that it's a bipartisan program. Since it's a mandatory program on the federal level, which means that it's not subject to the appropriations process and doesn't have a regular timely review, it's oftentimes flies under the radar for the staff up there. So initially, just to sort of level set for them before we even talk about an IRS, issue, we need to remind them that it's one of the highest performing federal programs that the federal government operates. So most staff are not aware that child support's one of the highest performing federal programs, that it returns $5 in collections for every $1 invested. It's also the third largest program touching families after Medicaid and the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. And it collects over $30 billion annually. Probably not news to your listeners, but when it's $30 billion, that's almost twice the size of TANF, the Temporary Assistance to Needy Families Program, which more staff know about than child support. So when an issue like the IRS federal taxpayer information issue comes up, we first have to sort of introduce them again to child support. And this issue came up, it's been sort of bubbling for a while, but it initially came up when the House took a closer look at the Tribal Child Support Enforcement Act, S-534, that was adopted by unanimous consent. So there was no debate in the Senate. It was bipartisan. It was adopted, 100 votes to zero, which is essentially unanimous consent, and then moved over to the House. The Tribal Child Support Enforcement Act does basically two things. First, under the bill, the Tribal Child Support Enforcement Act have two major components. It's a fairly small bill, but two important components. First, under the bill, tribal child support agencies would have direct access to the federal tax refund offset program to help them support families. Currently, they typically have to go to a state to get a waiver to do so. There are about 61 tribes right now that receive 4D funds to operate a child support agency, and a lot of the tribes rely heavily on the offset program to support their families. So direct access would allow them to, in a more timely way, receive those offsets without waiting for a state to approve them, those waivers. Secondly, because of the way tribal child support agencies often run very lean, they typically depend on contractors to help them process those offsets. Those contractors might be sort of part-time attorneys that they've contracted with or other private contractors. So this bill not only would provide tribes with direct access to federal tax refund offsets, but it attempted to assist and make more streamline the tribal agencies' ability to use contractors, keeping in mind that those contractors would abide by the same safeguards of taxpayer information as they do currently. But it would essentially codify into federal law the ability of tribes to use those contractors. Fast forward to now, the IRS back in February sent a notice to all state agencies essentially saying that the way that the contractor language is structured in IRS code, that contractors really are only supposed to have access to three pieces of information: Social Security number, name and address of the individual, and the amount of the offset. Well, for over 20 years or so, the IRS and the Office of Child Support Enforcement have essentially agreed that contractors could have access to more than those three pieces of information that are currently in code under Section 6103, but that IRS, when they would do their regular audits, would find that the state agency was out of compliance for purposes of that section, And because of that, and because the program was still operating with no breach of confidentiality, no, you know, intentional breaches, that they would just hold those findings of not strictly meeting that code. They would hold those findings in abeyance. So roughly 48 states over the last 20 or so years have had those findings held in abeyance. IRS, and it's still not clear exactly what precipitated it. Some have said that I think that the House tax staff and the Joint Committee on Taxation had a meeting with IRS and said, hey, whoa, 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 what are you doing sort of exceeding the boundaries of the IRS code and providing or allowing contractors access to more than the code allows in terms of information? You need to stop that, IRS. So IRS in February issued a notice to child support agencies saying that effective October 1 of this year, that in so many words, agencies had to fix that. They had to fix it with their contractors. And after October 1, if they hadn't done that, they were going to start receiving warning letters from the IRS. And very shortly after that, those agencies will lose access to the offset program. So that obviously has caused quite a bit of consternation among our members. We, ANCIA, have taken the lead in convening meetings with Senate Finance Committee and Ways and Means Committee staff, Democratic and Republican staff alike, child support policy and tax policy staff alike, to try to find a resolution to the issue, a fix to the issue before October 1, especially because IRS's notice, which was pretty unusual, they even cited within the notice that legislation needed to be enacted by Congress. And they pointed out the Tribal Child Support Enforcement Act as a piece of legislation that Congress should take seriously in order to fix it. So we've had conversations with staff, leaders of ANCIA, NCCSD, the tribes. They have become much more up to speed on the issue, but no resolution yet. Similar conversations have been occurring with the Office of Child Support Enforcement and IRS. But at this point, there isn't any resolution. The clock's ticking, but we continue to push it, Tim.
So, Tom, you talked about the Tribal Child Support Enforcement Act, the S-534. Can you tell us more about what that is, who's been involved, and what is the status now? Where does it lie? And a little bit more about ANCIA's involvement with that.
Sure. So the Tribal Child Support Enforcement Act has been a longstanding bill. It's been introduced a number of years. It's always had ANCIA's support. And as I noted before, it is the bill that would give tribes direct access to the offset program. And it is a bill that attempted to resolve the contractor issue. They have not, however, reintroduced the bill on the Senate side this year. We've talked with the leaders of that bill, and the leaders are pretty powerful leaders. It's Senate Finance Committee Chairman Ron Wyden, Democrat from Oregon, and John Thune, a Republican from South Dakota, who is very high up in the Senate Republican leadership. They've made the judgment at this point that the issue as a whole needs to be resolved, that introducing the bill is essentially, would be a marker, that they wouldn't get any traction on it legislatively, that the bigger issue of resolving the contractor issue, not only for tribes, but for state and local agencies, is much more important. And that's where the focus needs to be at this point.
Yeah, so now it's kind of a wait and see game.
Exactly. It's very much a wait and see game. And unfortunately, as everybody has seen, even with the debt limit negotiations, Congress loves to wait until the final minutes before, literally sometimes the final minutes before they act. And it's my fear that given the focus on debt limit and some other major pieces of legislation and how child support, albeit important, is a program much like many other programs that rarely receives a standalone focus when it comes to the Hill, that the issue, also given the August recess, which Congress loves to take, that the issue may not be resolved until sometime in September, perhaps days before the October 1 deadline, unless there's some administrative agreement within IRS and OCSC and or legislative agreement that it will be resolved and that the issue can be kicked down the road a little bit longer before they receive or figure out an ultimate fix. But yes, the clock is ticking, and I just hope the alarm bell doesn't go off.
Yeah, for sure. It's got to make some people nervous.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. So, Tom, let's talk some more shop here. So recently, the House Ways and Means Work and Welfare Subcommittee held a hearing entitled "Welfare is Broken, Restoring Work Requirements to Lift Americans Out of Poverty." What did this hearing entail and what came out of it? And maybe just as importantly, was it a partisan or a nonpartisan kind of thing in nature? Can you speak to us about that?
Yeah, I'm happy to. You know, I was a little bit concerned when I saw the title of the hearing because it sounded like it was going to be a very, very partisan hearing. Anytime there's a discussion about so-called quote-unquote welfare or income assistance programs, oftentimes those kinds of discussions can get very contentious. This hearing, though, actually was fairly bipartisan in nature. I was pleased to see members on both sides of the aisle, and this may get a little wonky for your listeners, but some of those may have some knowledge of TANF. The discussion started to revolve around what's called work participation rates, which is essentially a metric that states need to use to demonstrate that they're moving recipients off of TANF into work. Well, the work participation rate, the WPR, as folks in the trade call it, is essentially a process measure as opposed to an outcomes measure. So what I mean by that, it's a process measure in terms of individuals who are receiving cash assistance have to document that they have spent 30 hours or so a week in work or activities, what it broadly defined. If they participate 29 hours a week, they are not counted as participating in work. So states ultimately, through the block grant, could get dinged for not meeting the WPR, depending on how many people don't meet that definition. So members on both sides of the aisle said, hey, you know, this WPR really is not working. Let's find ways of making it more flexible for states to encourage people to work, even if they can't work for various reasons for 30 hours or more. Let's find ways of providing more flexibility for those individuals to involve themselves in vocational education, apprenticeship, educational activities. Let's just make the program a little bit more flexible so TANF works not only for the federal government and the state agencies that administer the program, but also the recipients of TANF. So ultimately it became a pretty good hearing. It's also important for folks to know that child support oftentimes is tied with TANF if and when there is any consideration of renewing TANF. We have not seen a full renewal of the Temporary Assistance for Needy Family programs, nor any increase in the funding. Haven't seen any increase in the funding since the block grant was enacted in 1996. And we haven't seen a full review of TANF since 2005. So it's a program where if they started to move and they're talking about additional hearings, we may see some involvement in child support as well as part of sort of that income maintenance umbrella.
Lots going on.
Yeah, lots going on. And it's exciting to see that, and again, it was pretty bipartisan nature. It was exciting to see that there was at least some attention paid to TANF this year, and hopefully a little bit more in the months to come.
Yes, yes. So you talked about the upcoming August break that Congress tends to like to take. And, you know, something that is probably on most everybody's mind that's been in the news, you know, can't quite escape that, is the federal debt ceiling and the federal budget. Can you talk to us a little bit about your perspective and what you're hearing about that?
Sure. You know, it is sucking up all the policy oxygen in D.C., albeit there are only at this point like three or four people in the room trying to cut the deal. Just a few days ago, there were about 12 people in the room representing House and Senate leadership and the administration. And they found that 12 were too many cooks in the kitchen. So it's boiling down to a couple of members of the Biden administration and a couple of members of staff members of Speaker of the House, Kevin McCarthy. The debt limit, you know, just to remind everybody, it's not a new issue. We saw the debt limit almost breached three times under the Trump administration. Congress always, in a bipartisan fashion, found a way of extending or increasing the limit. The debt limit since the 60s has come up 78 times. Again, most people aren't aware of that because it was usually sort of a no-brainer for both the House and the Senate to just pass a bill. It's gotten politicized a couple of times. The last time it really became politicized was in 2011 under the Obama administration. Don't need to go into any of the details then, but the important takeaway was that then Vice President Biden was the chief negotiator for the White House on the debt limit. And then Majority Leader Mitch McConnell from the Senate was the Senate lead. So it's very much an issue that both sides are concerned about. Both sides have sort of painted themselves into different policy corners that they can't seem to find a way out of. I think the one agreement that both sides have is that breaching that limit, which may be as soon as June 1st, according to the Treasury Department, or mid-June, according to the Congressional Budget Office, anytime pretty soon, that it would be catastrophic. Not only the breaching the limit, not only would be catastrophic for the nation's economy, but the holders of U.S. debt through Treasury bonds that, you know, holders across the world, nations hold, you know, Treasury bonds and have found it to be a very, very safe investment. And if our deficit limit is breached, we may not be considered worldwide as a safe investment. So that's where the issue stands. I also, Tim, always try to think about this in terms of, so, you know, with the federal budget being so huge, the debt limit being so huge, you know, really, what does that mean? I mean, it's hard for me to get my head around a $31 trillion deficit. And it's hard for me to get my head around a $1 or $2 trillion or $3 trillion federal budget. So I try to boil it down into, let's just say that the federal budget is $1. What does that $1 comprise? And it helped me get some insight into why this debt limit conversation is so difficult. Of that $1, 62 cents is mandatory spending. So that's Medicare, Medicaid, child support, foster care, SNAP, things that federal government really doesn't have any control over. They spend on those programs as required by the beneficiaries. So 62 cents of that $1 goes to entitlements. Also of that $1, when you look at it broadly, 83 cents is revenues, but 17 cents of that dollar they have no revenues for. So they're already 17 cents in the hole for each federal dollar that they have to spend. 8 cents goes to servicing the debt, so bondholders. If you take defense off the table, which is 14 cents, yeah, you're left with domestic discretionary programs. And in order to begin to balance the budget, if you don't raise revenues, you hold harmless all of the mandatory spending, you take defense off the table, you take veterans off the table, the only way you would achieve balance would be by cutting everything else by at least 40%, which means if it was across the board cut, 40% cut to NIH, 40% cut to transportation, 40% cut to National Park Service, 40% cut to social services programs that aren't mandatory. Most members on both sides of the aisle would say, we're not doing that either. But if they're not going to do major entitlement reform, if they're not going to raise revenues, they don't have many options at this point. So that's one of the reasons why we're in this so-called mess that we're in right now, budgetarily and politically. And I don't see any quick pathway out, even if they pass some sort of debt limit extension in the next year or two. This issue is not going to go away until they find a way, in a bipartisan way, to raise revenues and or make some reforms to mandatory programs. Both of those options are very tough choices for both parties to make.
Absolutely. And I think you're right. Unfortunately, we're in familiar territory. We've been here before, but maybe not to this extent or to this amount. It's going to be interesting for sure. And I appreciate how you broke that down in terms of a dollar and how that plays out. For most of us, or maybe just for me, to think about a $31 trillion deficit or a $3 trillion budget, I can't quite wrap my head around that.
Yeah, exactly. And so when you do it in dollars and cents, you find out that they don't have many pennies to play with if they want to hold harmless a vast section of the federal budget.
Yeah. So, Tom, are there any other significant happenings on the Hill that you want to mention or bring to our attention? What else should our child support community kind of be paying attention to?
You know, I think it really is budget right now and debt limit. Clearly, the appropriations process will be underway. And even though child support, for the most part, is not subject to that appropriations process, it's always good for our members to keep track of that. I think one of the policy issues that we need to continue to track over the next couple of months, and it's even come up within the deficit reduction negotiations, is strengthening or additional work requirements of individuals receiving SNAP or TANF or perhaps Medicaid. I think we need to track that closely. It may affect are at least the beneficiaries, the customers we serve. Most of those discussions aren't really big budget savers, but they are policy and philosophical differences between the two parties, and that individuals that even might be working, but they can't meet all the paperwork requirements to show that they're working, they may fall off of some of those key assistance programs and then have to rely on child support payments even more so than they are currently.
Yeah. So ultimately, what you're saying is the families that are the recipients or the people that we serve are the ones most impacted by this.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And again, most of them are working, but the requirements that they're considering would have additional paperwork burdens for them and for that matter, the state and local agencies to track and document in order for them to receive their benefits.
Yeah. Well, Tom, I'm so glad to finally be able to have you on the podcast. Your involvement with NCIA is crucial, it's important, and it's vital to the child support program and for our association. Thank you for taking time out of your busy day to sit and talk to our membership and to others listening in. I hope that you will come back from time to time and keep us updated. Thank you also to our listeners for your time today. On behalf of the NCIA Communications Committee, I'm Tim Leitner, and this has been On Location. On Location is available on iTunes, Anchor, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and anywhere you get your podcasts. We have a lot of great episodes on the way, so be sure to subscribe and listen to all of our previous episodes as well. We also appreciate your ratings, your feedback, your comments, and your suggestions. If you'd like to be a guest on the show, please reach out to us on the contact link on our website. On Location is a production of the NCIA Communications Committee with special production assistance from Joe Mamlin and me. Thanks again for joining me. I'm Tim Leitner, and this has been On Location.